From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, not everyone can lawfully possess a firearm in California. Firearm owners, for example, who have suffered a mental health-related event in their life, are prohibited from possessing a firearm. It's the responsibility of the state's Department of Justice to collect information from the state's superior courts and mental health facilities to make sure persons with a mental illness who possess a firearm are identified and their firearms are confiscated. According to a recent report by the California State Auditor, however, the reporting system is just not working. What are the problems and what can be done to address them? We'll ask California State Auditor Elaine Howe. We'll also hear from Duan Utek, Fresno County Director of Behavioral Health, Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims, and California Superior Court Judge Hillary Chittick. Armed and potentially dangerous, the state auditor's report on armed persons with a mental illness.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from Paramount Agricultural Companies, growing healthy food for you and your family.
From Fresno, the Maddie Report, with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Our guest, California State Auditor Elaine Howe, has issued a report finding that insufficient outreach by the Department of Justice and poor reporting by the state's superior courts have limited the identification of those with a mental illness who possess a firearm. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Thank you.
Well, that report generated a lot of front-page news. Let's start at the beginning, though. What is the state law regarding possessing a firearm? What are the rules?
The state law prohibits someone who has been deemed mentally incompetent or has a serious mental illness from owning a firearm or purchasing a firearm in the state of California. So there's a system set up for the state to be able to identify those individuals if they currently possess a firearm and hopefully to go out and confiscate that weapon.
Okay, so let's walk through the process now of actually finding someone with a mental health event and then frankly, going about confiscating their firearm. What is the role of the superior courts in that process?
The superior courts have a very important role. So if an individual is in court and is deemed mentally incompetent to stand trial or is deemed to be a danger to him or herself or certainly a danger to others, the courts have a responsibility to report that information to the Department of Justice. What Justice does with that information once they receive it is they try to match that individual's name to their database of individuals who own firearms, a registered firearm owner in California, to determine whether or not that individual's weapon needs to be taken from them.
It seems like a logical process. Now, we also have mental health facilities. What is their role in the process?
Very similar to the court. So if an individual is involuntarily committed to a mental health facility because of a mental illness or an event, those mental health facilities are responsible, similar to the courts, to report that information to the Department of Justice so Justice can do the same thing, compare that individual's name to their database of firearms owners to determine whether or not that person owns a firearm and whether or not we need to take the steps to confiscate that weapon.
Is this system new? Has it been around for a while?
Well, the statute was enacted back in 2001. The database that the Department of Justice has where they match all of this information has been around since 2006. One interesting note, though, is California is the only state in the nation that has a system like this. Where we do this type of matching, and the courts and mental health facilities and the Department of Justice work together to try to identify these individuals.
So there in other states, there are people with firearms who have mental health issues, and those weapons are not being confiscated?
My understanding from our Department of Justice is that our state is unique in that we have courts and mental health facilities reporting to our Department of Justice, doing that matching, and then ultimately confiscating weapons. I don't know what other states do, but certainly DOJ and the courts assert that this is unique to our state.
So what is this thing called the Armed Prohibited Persons System Database? It's a mouthful.
Right. That is a mouthful. What that is that's the database that contains the matches. So, for example, we were speaking about the courts. The courts send information into the Department of Justice criminal unit, and then they have a civil unit. So that database. Then mental health facilities will be reporting to a mental health unit within DOJ. Those units then report the information, and there's a comparison to our database at DOJ that is a database of everyone in California that is registered as a registered firearm owner. When those matches occur, they're dumped into this armed prohibited persons database. So you have a positive match of an individual who is a registered firearm owner and has been deemed either by the court or by a mental health facility to have had an event that should preclude them from continuing to possess the weapon.
If they're in that armed prohibited person systems database, does that mean they automatically get their weapons confiscated?
Not necessarily. What the Department of Justice has to do is they've got to go through the process to make sure that the person who is reported by the courts that is matched up against the individual in the firearms database is the same person. So there's additional analysis that Justice has to do before they say, yes, this is an exact match, this person should surrender their weapon.
Okay, so some people change their names because they get married or for whatever reason. Okay.
Exactly.
How is this different, this process different than just the typical background check that the government does when people want to purchase a firearm?
Well, the background check is similar. I mean, that's ahead of the game. So before I can own a weapon, I go into a gun shop and I want to purchase a weapon, and there's a 10-day period where there's a background check that's done by the Department of Justice, and then that determination is made, yes, this person has the ability to own a weapon, can possess a weapon. The system we're talking about today is a little bit different. I'm already a registered firearm owner. I've already purchased a weapon. I've gone through the background check. But now I've had an event in my life that questions my mental capacity, my incompetence to stand trial as an example, or I've been deemed a danger to myself or other individuals in the community. So now that weapon needs to be taken away from me.
Well, that clarifies the issue very well. We're talking with California State Auditor Elaine Howe about a recent report she had on how effective the state is in identifying the mentally ill who possess firearms. So you noted in your report that courts have certain mental health reporting requirements. Have the courts been reporting all the individuals?
Surprisingly to us, no. The answer to that is no. What we did is we looked at the Department of Justice and determined how many of these types of events had been reported by the 58 courts in California, and we found 34 of those courts were reporting very low numbers, and that seemed surprising to us. So we surveyed those 34 courts and found that 29 of those courts didn't even know they were responsible for reporting these types of events. So that was significant from our perspective. Part of the problem is Department of Justice not reaching out to the courts to make sure that they were aware of any specific requirements. But certainly, we think the court system has significant responsibility in this as well.
So 29 of the 58 courts were not reporting or under-reporting?
Well, some courts were under-reporting. Some we saw there were no reports at all, and that really surprised us. And when we surveyed those courts, many of them were not aware that if they had a situation in the courtroom where they deemed someone mentally incompetent to stand trial, that information needed to be reported to our Department of Justice for this particular program.
Yeah, I did notice in your report that 7 courts didn't know how many court determinations they failed to report. And 4 of those 7 were in the Valley, Fresno, Madera, Kings, and Tulare.
Right, right. There were a lot of in the Valley. There were several courts in the Bay Area. But again, 34 courts, 34 out of 58. So it's widespread throughout the state.
Okay. So the courts that did report, there were some that did report. Did they do a good job? Did they report all of the mental health determinations?
No, we were finding similar for those courts that did report. They were not reporting all of the typical types of events that determinations that are made in the courtroom, such as I said earlier, mentally incompetent to stand trial, danger to oneself or others. Those are situations where if that's a determination that's made in the court, the courtroom by the judge, that information needs to be reported to the State Department of Justice. And we weren't seeing that happening in all cases.
So it seems like a little bit hit or miss. It's not consistent.
Right. It's inconsistent. And I think one of the recommendations we made to Justice and to the court system is to collaborate and do a better job of making sure that the courtrooms are aware of their reporting responsibilities.
How timely are the courts in getting this information to DOJ?
Well, there's some legislation that changes the rules, but when we conducted the audit, what the statute said is that information needed to be reported immediately by both mental health facilities.
Immediately is
right.
In the eye of the beholder.
Exactly. And some of the courts defined that as a couple of court days. Some courts defined that as longer than that. So we use that metric. So if a court said, well, we expect to report this information within 2 court days, so we said, okay, that's what we're going to measure you against. L.A. in particular, L.A. Criminal Court, and there's an L.A. Mental Health Court. And we found that they were taking, on average, 6 to 7 court days, which, again, if you think about court days, that's over a week, because court days is usually Monday through Thursday. Right. So if you're talking 6 or 7, that could be up to 2 weeks before this individual is reported to the Department of Justice.
So that's a problem, obviously. What about mental health facilities? They also have reporting requirements. What did you find there?
Mental health facilities also have reporting requirements. Again, they are required to report immediately after the first of the year. This will change with some new enacted legislation. But mental health facilities actually did a pretty good job of reporting the information. They're required to report it electronically. That went into effect in 2012.
I assume that will speed up the process.
That certainly has sped up the process and made sure that the information gets to DOJ very promptly. What we did find, however, is there were some mental health facilities that were not reporting. Part of the problem there was justice didn't even know those facilities existed and were treating individuals with mental health issues. So we had a recommendation that justice needs to work with our State Department of Health Services, which licenses mental health facilities, to make sure that the inventory of facilities that should be reporting is accurate, so justice knows who should be reporting and who is or is not reporting.
So let's assume justice gets the complete list of mental health facilities. Are they helping those facilities to determine which patients need to be identified and how to actually go about submitting a report?
They need to do a better job of that. They had done some outreach, but it's been a while. They've put out a couple of bulletins, did some training, a couple of training programs, but we think they need to do a better job of making sure that these facilities are aware of the types of individuals and the situations that should be reported to justice.
So all of this has led to some recommendations that you have for the courts and for mental health facilities. What are your recommendations?
Well, key recommendations I think are of utmost importance is Department of Justice needs to work with our Administrative Office of the Courts, which is kind of an umbrella agency over the courts. Even though the courts have a certain amount of independence, that entity can assist DOJ in making sure that the courts are aware of their reporting requirements. The other thing that justice is uniquely positioned to do is to do an analysis of the 58 courts like we did and said, boy, some of these courts, it looks like they're not reporting very high numbers. Reach out to those courts to make sure they understand what they're required to do. Similar on the mental health side, same thing. Do an analysis at least every 6 months of the mental health facilities and make sure that if there's a drop-off in reporting, why did that happen? And reach out to that facility to make sure, again, that they're aware of what they're required to do.
And not just present the numbers, but also take a look at the numbers. I assume that training is also part of this. You would like to see DOJ do more training as
absolutely,
well?
Absolutely. Not only at the court level, but certainly at the mental health facility level, especially when you have more facilities getting licensed. They may not be familiar with the state requirements and what their responsibilities are. So we think Department of Justice should provide more training, both in the at the court level and certainly at mental health facilities.
Talking with California State Auditor Elaine Howe about a recent report her office issued on identifying armed persons with a mental illness. All this data that's being collected or not being collected, how well is the Department of Justice doing in identifying those people that have a mental event but still have a firearm?
Well, actually, when we pulled a sample of some cases to determine whether or not the analysis that the Department of Justice staff had done, we found some errors. We actually found some instances where the analysis showed that this person, no, is not a prohibited person, should not have their weapon confiscated, and that was an incorrect conclusion. 3 of the 8 that we looked at were problematic. So we have concerns there. What we found is that one individual is doing that analysis and you don't have a separate individual, a supervisor or someone kind of coming behind and doing some quality control to make sure that the determination is accurate. Certainly when you make a determination that's incorrect on the side of, no, this person is not a prohibited person when in fact they should be, is problematic from a safety perspective.
What about the information that's available to the Department of Justice? Are they using all the information that's at their disposal to identify these folks?
Not necessarily. They certainly have information that's reported from the courts and the mental health facilities, but sometimes that information may be incomplete. A perfect example is they report information about an individual and they don't have their entire birth date. They may have just the year rather than the month, day, and year. And they're deciding not to use that information because it's incomplete. They still could do the analysis and perhaps do some additional research to determine whether or not that person, in fact, is a firearm owner and should be prohibited from using that weapon. So we think they need to exercise due diligence and doing a better job of using some of the information that they get that may not be complete. They can follow up and get the information they need.
A little more thorough. They may be arguing that they lack the staff to do that, but how are they doing in terms of processing the cases, and what's the backlog?
Well, they actually have a cap. They try to keep their daily backlog at around 1,200 cases, which seems high to folks, but they get a lot of these reports coming in from the courts, and we think that'll go up as the courts improve, and mental health facilities report a significant number of individuals that may have a mental illness that should preclude them from owning a weapon.
So if the courts and the mental health facilities do a better job, DOJ is going to be even more overwhelmed.
Exactly, and we talk about that in the report. And you're right. Staffing is an issue for them. Their unit is relatively small that does these analyses. They have 10 staff. And their backlog, again, their goal was on a daily basis to have it around 1,200. We saw that they exceeded that goal in many instances. And quite frankly, we made a recommendation that the goal needs to be lower than that. It needs to be between 400 and 600 on a daily basis. We think they can be more efficient.
I think I also read in your report that one of the problems is the staff that's supposed to be doing this work gets shifted over to take care of background checks when there's a spike in the number of people after an event, Sandy Hook or whatever, who now want weapons. And so they shift their resources to doing the background checks and leaves this other situation really unattended.
That's exactly right. That's what Justice told us. As far as the background checks, there's a 10-day requirement that background check has to be completed. So the individuals, these 10 individuals in this armed prohibited persons unit, had been shifted to conduct background checks. So that's why the backlog continued to get bigger and bigger. It's my understanding now from the department that they'll be able to keep those individuals in the what they call the APPS unit, armed prohibited persons unit, to focus on those analyses and not draw them away to do background checks in the future.
So maybe that daily backlog is going to go down, but they also have an historical backlog, which was, I guess, over a million folks. They've worked that down to only 380,000. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to eliminate the backlog by 2016. Is that going to happen?
Based on our analysis, no. They assure us that they will meet that goal. When they responded to the report, and we spoke with them during the course of the audit, they're confident that they'll meet that. But in using their statistics from the last few years and when they've been reviewing these firearms owners, we think it will take them to 2019 to be able to get through those 380,000 that are remaining.
Yeah, I think the number I saw in your report was they do 43,000 a year, so chances of them hitting that target, if they're sticking with those numbers, probably isn't going to happen. What about DOJ's efforts to confiscate firearms? Mm-hmm. What were your findings there?
Well, we looked at that from the perspective of how many agents do they have, how many sweeps have they done. In the last few years, they've only done about 3 sweeps. They were able to confiscate about a little over 4,000 weapons. When we started the audit earlier this summer in July of 2013, there were 20,000 armed prohibited persons out there, over 40,000 weapons. So they've been able to confiscate a little over 4,000.
So about 10%.
Right. But there was legislation and appropriation given to the Attorney General, $24 million, to hire more agents. She is moving forward with that. They have hired about 10. They're intending to hire 30 more agents to be able to do this type of analysis, because they have to actually analyze, make sure that that is the appropriate person, and then find that person and try to find the weapon and confiscate it.
We've only got about 30 seconds left in this thing, but I want to ask you a last question. That is, what are your recommendations to DOJ to improve their ability to confiscate these weapons?
Well, we certainly talked about improving the analyses that they do in determining if this person truly is a prohibited person, and then moving forward with hiring agents. We think they are moving in the right direction with respect to that, and being able to put more people out on the street to try to confiscate weapons from individuals who should not have them.
We're talking with California State Auditor Elaine Howe about a recent report she did on the mentally ill and their possession of firearms. So how do the various state agencies respond to the audit? Let's talk about the Department of Justice first. Did they address all your concerns?
They addressed all of the recommendations, and for the most part, they agreed with what we recommended. The concerns that they raised were twofold. One was a resource issue. Do we have enough staff to do the analysis? And they don't feel that they do. I mean, they certainly are able, because of some additional money that they received this year.
Does that $24 million we talked about in the last segment, is that going to fill that hole?
Well, that'll fill the hole from the perspective of individuals going out to confiscate confiscate weapons. But as we spoke about a little bit earlier, their unit that does these analyses in the first place is only 10 individuals. So they still have concerns there. Hopefully they don't divert those folks in the future as they've had to do in the past. But that resources are an issue. The other issue that they raised that in their response to the report is whether or not they have statutory authority, certainly over the courts. Do we have the authority to instruct the courts as to what they should be doing as far as what should be reported to our department? Our response to that is, yes, you have a responsibility, and you can work with the Administrative Office of the Courts, which is the administrative arm of the judicial branch, in working with the courts to make sure that the courts are informed of what their responsibilities are. The other thing that we said to DOJ is you're in a unique position. You have a unique perspective. You know what's being reported by all of the courts, and you can look and do an analysis of that information and work with AOC, especially for those courts that seem to be reporting low numbers, to really dig in and figure out, is it because those are truly should be low numbers, or is it that those courts don't understand what they're required to do?
So you're telling DOJ, listen, training is not telling. So you can train the courts to do a little better job, I guess, in reporting. So let's talk about the courts. Mm-hmm. The Administrative Office for the Courts, how did they respond to the audit?
Overall, they responded positively. I think they understand the seriousness of the issue, the fact that many courts weren't even aware of the responsibilities. So I think the AOC is intending to collaborate and work with the Department of Justice to make sure that the courts throughout the state are aware of what their responsibilities are and that they're fulfilling those responsibilities.
Is AOC, Administrative Office of the Courts, and DOJ, Department of Justice, alphabet soup here, are they both going to be doing training in this area?
I think it'll primarily be DOJ that provides the training. Again, they're positioned to go into the courts or to provide information to AOC, bulletins, for example, that can go out to the courts or to the mental health facilities, instructing those facilities as to what they should do and how they should go about reporting the information.
And I was reading your report. One court kind of stood out, and that was San Francisco. They seemed particularly reluctant to cooperate with the audit. For example, it said that in conservatorship proceedings, they can't, quote, dictate to the DA what petitions to bring and what relief to seek, unquote. What's your response to that?
Well, our response, actually published in the report, is that it was interesting to us for them to have that type of response when earlier in that same transmittal to my office, they indicated that they were going to reach out to district attorney's offices and make sure that the forms had an indication where someone's deemed mentally incompetent to stand trial, that that information is, in fact, reported to justice. So it was surprising to us for the court to take that perspective.
I also note in your report not a single firearm prohibition in any of the more than 2,100 conservatorship orders that they had in San Francisco. So that's interesting, zero out of 2,100. Where do we go from here? What's the follow-up of this audit?
Well, the follow-up process for any of our audits, and this one has garnered a lot of attention from the members of the legislature. There are three members that requested the audit, but we've briefed many members of the legislature. There may be some oversight hearings, but certainly my office has a process where we hear from the agency 60 days, 6 months, and 1 year after we issue the report. So we should be getting status reports, not only from the courts, from the AOC, DOJ as well. So we'll be publishing that information on our website as to what progress those entities are making and implementing the recommendations.
So the state auditor is watching.
That's right.
I'm going to do a follow-up. Well, I want to thank State Auditor Elaine Howe for joining us.
Up next, what's being done to ensure that the mentally ill in the San Joaquin Valley do not possess firearms? We'll talk to Dewan Utek, Fresno County Director of Behavioral Health, Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims, and California Superior Court Judge Hillary Chittick.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We've been talking about the state auditor's report entitled Armed and Potentially Dangerous, Armed Persons with Mental Illness. As noted earlier, the state auditor found that a majority of the California's 58 county courts failed to report armed persons who have a mental illness to the Department of Justice so their weapons could be confiscated as required by state law. Is this problem more or less pronounced in the San Joaquin Valley? And what about realignment, the shift of nonviolent, non-serious criminals from state prisons to county jails? Has it made county jails more akin to mental health facilities? We've got three perspectives on that and other issues. Duan Utek is the Fresno County Director of Behavioral Health. We also have California Superior Court Judge Hillary Chittick and Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims joining us. Welcome all of you to the Matty Report Valley Views Edition.
Thank you.
Well, Sheriff Mims.
Thank you, Mark.
Great. Sheriff Mims, let me talk to you first about an issue concerning concealed carry weapons permits. And it's my understanding that you're pretty supportive of such permits and that you've been issuing many or more than any other sheriff in the state. So I was just wondering, in light of the state auditor's report that the state Department of Justice records regarding who's been declared mentally incompetent are incomplete, are you at all concerned that you may be issuing concealed weapons permits to the mentally ill?
Well, of course it's a concern. However, we check more than the state database when we do our background check for issuing the concealed carry permits. Remember that the state information comes from our local jurisdiction. So we do local checks, and we can see just from our local research who could be prohibited because of mental health issues.
So the state's doing an incomplete job. I think everybody seems to agree about that. Your office is doing more than the state is doing in terms of making sure that weapons don't get into the hands of the wrong people?
Yes, I have retired deputy sheriffs that conduct the background investigations, so I'm very highly confident in their ability to do the proper research. And in fact, in the 7 years I've been sheriff, I have not had an issue with somebody mentally ill having a CCW. I've had other issues. For instance, you know, of course, I expect good decision making, and I've revoked license if somebody's caught drunk driving. But never anybody that has ended up with a mental illness issue.
Okay. Well, Judge Chittick, you know, we often hear about this thing called a 5150 involuntary psychiatric hold proceeding. Can you explain the process to our listeners?
Sure. If a law enforcement officer or doctor encounters a person who they believe reasonably to be gravely disabled, which means unable to care for their food, clothing, or shelter, or a person who's they believe to be dangerous to self or others, they can take them to a psychiatric facility for a 72-hour, they call it a 72-hour hold, where they can be observed. If their medication is out of balance, they can get their medication corrected. They can do a variety of other things like that. They can't be forced to take medication without a court hearing, but we do those court hearings on a routine basis. Once, if there's a belief that the person needs to be held for longer than 72 hours, there can be a 14-day hold, a 30-day hold, 180-day hold. The idea is essentially to take individuals and allow them to be observed by professionals to make a determination whether they are dangerous to self or others, or gravely disabled.
You know, there's a lot of interaction, it seems like, between the criminal justice system and the mental health program. So, Duan, I wanted to ask you, how does a county department of behavioral health like yours typically interact with the courts?
Well, as Judge Chittick was indicating, for those individuals with a grave disability, we represent them in the conservatorship hearing. So we assess them to determine whether or not their grave disability warrants us to put them on an LPS conservatorship.
LPS stands for
Lanterman Petras Short Act.
Okay, which I'm glad you said LPS then.
which is the act that established the 5150 statutes.
Okay.
And so we have a team that does that. We also, that's in the probate court. We also are represented in the behavioral health courts, both in adult and the juvenile justice system. The medical director in our department evaluates defendants who are found incompetent to stand trial in the criminal courts and recommends treatment to help restore them to competence. And then we also have representation in the family courts.
Okay, so quite a bit of interaction. Sheriff Mims, I wanted to ask you your thoughts about realignment because it has some interaction here with this topic. Has the state's policy of moving nonviolent, non-serious offenders from state prisons to county jails increased the number of mentally ill that you're seeing in the county jail?
It has not. It has increased the amount of violence that we have in the jail, not so much because of the mentally ill, but because of the type of inmate now that we're keeping in a local facility. I will say that now we are becoming more like a state prison, And I want to say that the nonviolent, non-serious offender is not an accurate reflection of the inmates that are being realigned. It only applies to their current offense. We have very many very serious, very violent offenders who are now called non-non-non. A good example is one of the defendants, one of the people responsible for the murder of Mike Reynolds' daughter, is now considered a non-non-non and under supervision by county probation. So it's more the effect that our increase in violence is of the type of offender that we're keeping. And remember, these are the same people that moved through our system prior to realignment. They came to us before moving on to state prison.
Yeah, and you're interested. It's interesting that your comment about nonviolent, non-serious is just simply speaking to their current infraction, not their previous criminal history.
That's correct.
So let me ask you this, Sheriff Emmons. I want to do a follow-up here. It's been reported that there's a perverse effect of realignment and that many offenders actually manage to dodge drug treatment and other rehabilitation programs by choosing to do straight time behind bars. Are you seeing that in the county jail?
Absolutely. See, the last thing that an offender wants is once they get out of jail, they don't want what we all in the business call a tail or some kind of supervision once they're out. It is an advantage to them, frankly, and to law enforcement to have that supervision so that they can get back where they need to be and not reoffend. It's not to anybody's benefit if they serve the time and get out with absolutely no supervision, because they're going to more than likely end up right back in jail.
I think this is Judge Chittick. I think we need to separate out sort of the mentally ill from the realignment. Realignment could be a whole show all by itself.
It has been.
I do think there are options for creating that tail by splitting the sentences. And there's a variety of, I think this is a pretty new process, the sheriff and how she handles the jail, the courts and how we handle sentencing, probation and how they handle supervision are all sort of in a learning process to figure out how to work this to have the best outcomes from a community safety perspective. I do think that one of the things realignment has done is to the extent there were mentally ill people who were in prison, many of those mentally ill people are now coming back for local supervision. And so I think it gives great opportunities, for example, for better partnerships between the Department of Behavioral Health and the Probation Department to provide better supervision. In many ways, I have a lot of confidence in our local people to do a good job of supervising individuals, whereas if somebody just went off to some state place where they were just a cog in a machine, I didn't have that confidence. So I think there are opportunities. We're all learning how to do it better, I think.
Yeah, that was actually one of the selling points with realignment, that the locals could do a better job of rehabilitation than the state could. I want to follow up with another question with you, Sheriff Mims, and that is it was recently recommended that Fresno County get almost $80 million to replace the 499-bed South Annex built in the 1940s with a new 300-bed facility. I was just wondering how much of this money is going to go to dealing with the mentally ill in terms of bed space, et cetera.
The whole purpose and one of the requirements for applying for and being granted funding was to make sure that we had treatment space and programming space in the new facility. So we made that a focus of the new building, that we would have proper places to deal with the mentally ill as well as programming and treatment. And that's what really helped us win this particular award. And we go to Los Angeles in January to get the final decision. However, I believe we're still going to be successful. Our old jail is not conducive to any kind of proper treatment, any kind of proper inmate supervision. We can't keep it warm in the winter or cool in the summer, and the conditions are just outrageous, and it needs to be replaced.
Well, hopefully the money will be there to do that. Duane, I want to ask you about mental health budgets being cut. Is one of the unintended consequences that more of these problems are being handled now in the criminal justice system rather than the mental health system?
Well, we've definitely seen a shift to the criminal justice system. While incidence of mental illness doesn't necessarily change significantly over time, where individuals are located does shift between treatment facilities and the criminal justice system. We actually, while we've experienced significant cuts in the past in behavioral health, we're in a period of time now where there is some funding to really reshape our delivery system and ensure that our continuum of care, that the gaps that we have identified and are identifying get filled with those funds that are available. One source of those funds is Prop 63, the Millionaire Tax, the Mental Health Services Act. And another source of new funding is going to be the Affordable Care Act. Many of the clients we currently serve within the Department of Behavioral Health will become newly eligible for either the new Medi-Cal, the federally funded Medi-Cal, or Covered California. And we hope that some of the funds we're using for that indigent population now, we can use to fortify our system of care. And then there's one other source of funding that is a competitive grant that's new, SB 82, the Investment in Mental Health Wellness Act. And we intend to apply for grant funding to create a better system for crisis mental health services, crisis response.
So there's a lot of different ways to respond to this problem. So Judge Chittick, in your opinion, what's the most cost-effective way to deal with the mentally ill who commit non-serious crimes? Incarceration, treatment, rehabilitation, probation, what?
Well, I think just from a cost perspective, treatment and rehabilitation is clearly the most effective, but I don't think you can separate those out. In our behavioral health court, we have a big focus on treatment and rehabilitation, but we also utilize probation services for drug testing and for supervision. And when people do not do what they're supposed to do, they can be incarcerated. So it's useful to have all three, but I do think out of the first step out of the box should be the efforts at treatment and rehabilitation. Many people who get appropriate medication and treatment don't commit further crimes, and that's in all of our interests.
You know, Sheriff Mims, I want to ask you your thoughts on Laura's Law. That's a California law that allows for court-ordered assisted outpatient treatment or forced antipsychotics. It's my understanding that to qualify for the program, a person has to, number one, have a serious mental illness, and two, have a recent history of psychiatric hospitalizations, jailings or acts, threats or attempts of serious violence, violent behavior toward themselves or others. There's an issue here of whether or not the medications that these people receive should be given voluntarily or should be mandatory. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I will defer to the good judge on this issue. It is a court process. I personally feel voluntary first, of course, before forced treatment is administered, because that is maybe what it takes. But I will defer to the judge.
Okay, Judge, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it should be explored in Fresno. It has been in New York for a number of years under the name Kendra's Law, and it has been found to be quite effective. And I think it's something we should definitely explore here. One of the challenges of it is that it requires that treatment be provided voluntarily before it is mandated, and we have to therefore have the treatment available. And I think it's unfair to have mandatory treatment before you provide voluntary treatment. So I think it should definitely be explored.
Dwan, what do you think?
I concur with Judge Chittick. You really have to have an established pattern of noncompliance with treatment in order to affect Laura's Law. And, you know, unfortunately, many individuals with mental illness who would qualify for this, they just, because of their illness, lack the judgment or insight into making good decisions for themselves. So I agree that it has a place. There are a few counties in California who have implemented it. They tend to be small counties, and we will certainly work together to explore whether or not that would work in Fresno County. It does take resources to do that, not just on the treatment side, but also on the court side.
Okay, well, up next, when it comes to criminal activity in the mentally ill, what's fact and what is fiction? And for the mentally ill who do commit crimes, are there better ways to deal with them than sending them to jail? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're talking about the state auditor's report on armed persons with mental illness and how it impacts the situation here in the San Joaquin Valley with California Superior Court Judge Hillary Chittick, Dewan Utrick, the Fresno County Director of Behavioral Health, and Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims. So, Sheriff Mims, I want to start with you. How much criminal activity is attributable to the mentally ill? Are they a large part or a small part of the crimes being committed?
Well, I can judge this by the people in the Fresno County Jail who have been deemed mentally ill. They're not a large or a majority part of our population. However, it is a significant part of our population in the jail. And when it comes to law enforcement and the tools that we have, we don't have a lot of choices when it comes to how we deal with calls when we do get called to a scene and there's somebody mentally ill, because usually some kind of crime has been committed. And for law enforcement officers, you know, the tool that's used is they bring them to jail. I do want to commend Dewan and her group of people that work with those in the Fresno County Jail who have mental illness issues. I will say we've much improved our communication process and the treatment options that we have. And so we're trying to deal with that. But it's very difficult for law enforcement officers on the street because they only have so many options because they've got to get on to the next call.
Yeah, Judge Chick, do you see this as being a big problem in the criminal justice system, dealing with the mentally ill?
I do. I mean, the criminal justice system has a lot of different issues that confront it. There are a significant percentage of people in the criminal justice system who have some level of mental illness, particularly people who are both mentally ill and addicted. They may, in absolute numbers, be a relatively small percentage of the population, say less than 20%, but they are much more difficult to supervise. They are harder to treat because of their mental illness in the criminal system. They are more apt to reoffend. They are more difficult for the jail to handle. I'm sure Sheriff Mims can confirm that. Somebody who is psychotic or schizophrenic is much more of a challenge. And for law enforcement officers who are out in the field, they can be really a challenge to deal with as well. I also commend the Department of Behavioral Health. They have, over the last 5 years or so, had clinicians who provide field assistance to law enforcement officers, and I think that's been a big help. But it's a significant challenge for the criminal justice system. Sheriff Mims told me once that the jail is like a backstop. It has to catch all the balls that all the other players miss. And so these folks end up in jail really because other parts of our whole system have missed them.
Yeah, that's a good point. Dewan, I wanted to ask you, it's been reported that the mentally ill are more likely to be victims of violence, and they're not actually typically the instigators. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. Most people with mental illness do not commit violence, and most people who commit violence are not mentally ill. And for most people, mental illness alone is not a significant risk factor for violence. However, as Judge Chittick mentioned, when you combine it with other factors like substance abuse, it can be a significant risk factor. And, you know, we see individual instances of significant violence like the mass shootings where mental illness does seem to be a significant contributing factor. So we have to be sensitive to that reality, but also recognizing that the vast majority of people with mental illness are not violent. And for them, one of the worst things we can do is to be afraid of them and treat them like they're dangerous.
You know, Sheriff Mims, for the mentally ill who are incarcerated, inadequate mental health care was one of the reasons why the federal judges ordered California to remove, you know, almost 10,000 inmates from its prisons. I'm just wondering, are you concerned at all that counties could soon be facing the same conundrum as more offenders are assigned to county jails under realignment, since county jails were never set up for either long holds or to treat the mentally ill?
That we are already experiencing what the state experienced, and as a result, they have this lawsuit. But two things with realignment that I, as a Fresno County Sheriff, and then California, the State Sheriff's Association, have recognized very early on that our issues are the long-term inmates. All county jails were built to only hold somebody sentenced for 1 year or less. Now we're getting significant sentences. I think our longest sentence so far is 18 years in the county jail. Along with realignment, they only do 50% of the time, but still, that's 9 years in a jail that was built to only hold commitments of 1 year. So that's what part of the realignment money to build local facilities was for, to build facilities that are better set up for long-term inmates. However, it's still a problem with all counties statewide. We just weren't built to handle these long-term sentences.
Yeah. Dwayne, I wanted to ask you, isn't there a large portion of the homeless population that's suffering from mental illness? And is there a more cost-effective way to treat them before they become homeless? Because some people think, you know, the homeless then commit crimes. So is there a better way to deal with the homeless situation so we don't have to deal with it as a criminal situation later on?
Well, it is true that many people who are homeless have either a mental illness or a substance abuse disorder. We are definitely increasing our outreach to the homeless population here in Fresno. We have staff who are dedicated, for instance, to the Poverello House, as well as an outreach team. We're working very hard to make sure that people who are in treatment also have access to safe and affordable housing. We've made it part of the core of our efforts as we're redesigning our system of care to include housing as part of the continuum of care, because we know that when individuals have safe housing and supportive housing, they tend to do better in treatment. Some people do equate being homeless with being mentally ill, and I don't think that's right. While many homeless people have a mental illness, most are not so ill that they would meet the criteria for involuntary treatment or hospitalization. And, you know, I just want to emphasize that homelessness is a very complex problem, and it can't be solved simply with a mental health approach.
Yeah. Sheriff Mims, do you see a homeless population as creating a problem for you in terms of crime? And if you do, what do you think is the best way to deal with that problem?
Well, it's a significant problem for mostly metropolitan police agencies, because the homeless tend to gather in the metropolitan areas where they, you know, have set up the camps. So it can be very violent. What we found in the areas where we handle, there's a drug dealing going on, there's prostitution, of course there's substance abuse, and it's a public health issue. So it's all encompassing. There's no single answer mark to the problem. It's everybody working together to try and really keep these camps from being established. I think, you know, keeping people moving, because then when they can't get established into a day-to-day routine that they become accustomed to, they might be more amenable to seeking services that they wouldn't normally accept.
You know, I want to end with this. You know, this whole conversation has been about the state auditor's finding that the state's done a poor job of confiscating weapons from the mentally ill. So let's end with this. What, if anything, do you think local jurisdictions should do to make sure that the mentally ill do not have weapons? So, Dwayne, I'll start with you first.
Well, I will let Sheriff Mims and Judge Chittick address the weapons issue. From our end, we have many tools that we can use to assess the danger of individuals with mental illness to themselves and others, but we have to interact with them in order to use those tools. And so it seems oftentimes in those mass shooting incidents that there was a period of disengagement, even if they were involved in mental illness. So our goal is to create programs and services that seek to engage clients in their own wellness and recovery and keep them engaged.
So proactive. Judge Chittick, what do you think?
I think that proactive aspect is really critical. You know, one of the things that we have worked hard with local law enforcement to do is to have training so that law enforcement officers can recognize the signs of mental illness and then have an easy on-ramp, if you will, to get that individual engaged in mental health treatment. And I think that's critical. Obviously, knowing who the mentally ill people are with weapons is also critical, and working to get them out of the hands of those individuals. And all of those, I think, happen better when we work together.
Okay, Sheriff Mims, you've got the last word.
Sure. You know, our local databases are what really helps us out. I have a secondary concern when it comes to the state data. For instance, there is a database that they use that are prohibited people because they've committed a certain crime, not because they're mentally ill. And what I found out is a lot of that data is not accurate. Something happened in the entry at the state level of data, and there's some people that are prohibited on the list that aren't really legally prohibited. So I'm just as concerned about maybe issues in the database that might prohibit somebody from having a firearm that aren't really prohibited. So it has to be done very carefully. I think the report did a good job about pointing out the oversight, and some of those errors could be stopped if there was proper oversight.
All right. Well, I want to thank our guests. Thank you very much for joining us. Duan Utek, the Fresno County Director of Behavioral Health, Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims, and California Superior Court Judge Hillary Chittick. Thanks, all of you, for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by just logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.